Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night. I'm Hunter, joined by Brody. No Silas today. He has classes today, unfortunately, so we're going to be Sci-Guy free. But World is officially in the books. It's over. Our Debate Night preview show last week that we filmed on Monday and then came out on Tuesday, predictions were actually pretty close overall. Hot round was pretty close. Yeah, I think we can claim that. Hot round was pretty close for round one. I think actually someone might have guessed it. We were all in that like 10 to 12 range, and hot ended up being 13.
I don't know if we,
but really it was 12.
I don't know if we would have guessed that ECC would have the hot round. I think we would have assumed it was going to be at Jones.
Yes. Well, that's what we were guessing. Mm-hmm. We were guessing Jones was going to have it, but we did predict the B pool thing, which we'll talk about that
that's
a little
nuts.
Bit. And then the winning score, we were in the right range. We were low. We were low for what it ended up being. I think we were in like the low to mid 40s and ended up being like 40.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with just weather conditions. The wind never got up crazy high, and the couple days that it was very windy, it was more earlier on during the day and not later when the leaders were playing. So scoring conditions, outside of it being obviously a little hot, a little humid, which I'm sure they probably discussed a lot on the broadcast. And this is where it's like always interesting doing this. This is like one of my favorite things after tournaments is what you heard on the broadcast, because you guys watch the coverage. I don't actually ever watch coverage. If anything, the only coverage I ever really watch is sometimes I'll watch FPO before my round, just to kind of see how the course is playing. But I don't ever go back and watch live coverage or anything like that. So I don't ever really get to see how the story is told or what they were saying was happening. And I think this one, they were probably more spot on because they were actually there. And we've talked about this before. That's a huge thing of where, you know, if Nate's walking the course before the tournament and he's able to see kind of playing conditions. I know Brian does that a lot as well. I think that adds a lot more to the coverage than when they are, you know, 700, 1,000 miles away and they're trying to say like what's going on. It's harder.
Well, I also think another thing that improved the coverage this week, in my opinion, was they had two different teams. So they were like typically for FPO and MPO, Ian or Terry or whoever's the main guy stays for both. This, they had, you know, Charlie, Val, Elaine for FPO, and then Ian, Doss, Brian for MPO. And I thought that helped a lot just because it's a long day if you have one guy doing commentary for both.
Both not just that too.
You're disc golf talking
it's two
about
different
it.
Tournaments. You're trying to know what's going on, all the storylines across two different tournaments versus just being able to focus on one. I think you're going to get a much better product when you have that.
Yeah, no, for sure. And being on site always helps. I mean, it also helps that the courses they've played before, they just saw DDO as well. So I think at DDO, I think they were on site as well. Am I wrong?
I could be wrong.
I feel like they were at, maybe they weren't. Only thing that was weird was like the post round interview. They like for at the end of the, I don't think they did this all the other days, but once they had a world champion, they brought Kristen and Paul into the booth. So like, they were doing commentary.
You didn't like that?
Super nitpicky. I didn't.
Oh.
But that's like.
They do that.
No,
they do that in other.
There's nothing wrong with it. I was just nitpicky.
They do that in, in other sports as well.
No, it's still, the interviews were good. All of that. I don't know. It felt weird, but it was completely fine. And I thought the commentary overall was good. A lot of people were coming after Elaine, is what it is.
I think a lot of that has to do with some of the biases toward her from the past.
It's just like, so Nate Doss has kind of turned his name around. A lot more people like Nate Doss nowadays. But for a period there, Nate Doss was doing just as good a job as he's doing right now, but people could not stand him. And I think it's because when he first started doing commentary, people didn't like him. And so it's a lot harder to change someone's mind back to being positive when it's already been negative than like if you just start off on a good foot. So I think that's somewhat what we're seeing with Elaine. Obviously, is she the best commentator ever? No, not by any means. But I think that is part of it, is like you go in looking to not like something she's going to say, just like people went in looking for something they didn't like about Doss when in reality he was fine. So Yeah, it's definitely a little bit of that.
Before we get further, we do need to congratulate the winners, because I'm sure we will get flamed in the comments if we don't. So shout out to Kristen Tatar, shout out to Paul Macbeth, 2022 world champions. And as far as, I mean, obviously a lot more drama, a lot more back and forth on the MPO side. There was a little bit of that early on when Kristen kind of had that dud round. I don't know if it was
like round three.
It was either round two or round three. She kind of just really, she just didn't putt well. I think she missed a whole lot of putts, which brought a whole bunch of people back into contention. But yeah, shout out to both of them for, taking it down.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Worlds always seems to be exciting. I mean, even on FPO, I think it was exciting because of who was running away with it, and knowing Kristen, it was for her first, and she's been in that position where, you know, she's been deserving of a title like that, or capable of a title like that for years, and just hasn't had the stars align yet. So even watching her run away with it, you could still feel the moment building because you knew what was coming at the end. And then on MPO, I think, as much of Paul becoming a six-time world champs of storyline, the big thing, we talked about this on Griplock a lot, was Aaron Gossage was a surprise that he could hold on. And Tristan Tanner, I kept expecting one of the two of them to crack. Because there was a point where Tristan was like one stroke behind the lead, a few holes ahead of him, and like he was putting pressure on in a different way. And then Aaron was able to hold on the whole tournament. And it was impressive. I do think part of it was the course. Both the courses, I think, played to his strengths, it seemed like, on
Yeah, the Aaron Gossage coming out of nowhere, I'm not really buying that too much, because if you know his game and you've watched him before, obviously he's not on a crazy amount of coverage, and so I can see how some people are like, who the heck is this guy? But if you go back, I think he was on coverage. I want to say he might have been on lead card at OTB. Earlier.
Yeah, then he finished third at OTB.
If you go back and you actually kind of see where his game was at and what he was, how he was playing, it's no surprise that someone like him or Tristan Tanner did well at this tournament. And for those guys too, especially, and really for anyone, it really just comes down to putting at these tournaments. If you're putting well, you're going to be in contention. If you're not putting well, you're not. And it's just one of those, how the putt's feeling. And I think we're going to see less and less, too, of the, oh, this guy just had a crazy hot round, but now he's on lead card and he's playing with all these really well-known players and there's cameras, and now he's going to fall apart. Like, I don't think you're going to see that as much as maybe you did in the past, of where you were expecting Gossage or Tristan to just like fall apart with the pressure. I think you're going to see more and more people be able to withstand that, because it's getting more and more cutthroat. It's getting more harder. And so I think a lot of people have been feeling that pressure and have been put in those positions a lot more than maybe in the past, of where they've gone from never playing in front of anyone, no one having any clue who they are, and then all of a sudden they get thrown in the spotlight and, you know, they crack a little bit. So I wasn't surprised at all to see either one. If anything, like, I know, you know, Tristan, I know him decently well. We've hung out and played some practice rounds and stuff. And it was one of those where it's like, when he's on, he is incredible. Like, he is
at DDO,
he is good.
At DDO, he was one of the players that caught COVID, correct?
Wasn't
he
playing with me?
Yeah,
he was playing with me at DDO, and he was actually, he dropped out. I remember it was on Jones, like right, the hole was right by the parking lot. Cause I remember him just like kind of walking off and like saying something to us. And we were all like, wait, what just happened? And yeah, he was basically just not feeling well at all, but he was top five at that point, top three maybe even.
Yeah, once round one happened, and then round two, he like stayed in contention from the B pool before he moved to the A pool, is when it hit me. I was like, I'm pretty sure at DDO he was up there, because I'm pretty sure that was one of the storylines, like him, Matty O, a few other guys had to drop from the tournament, and I thought that was a storyline. Yeah. But yeah, the B pool, I mean, as interesting as it is, it's not shocking, I don't think, that someone was able to get out of the B pool and put themselves in contention.
It's a
with how deep the field is and how the course is.
Yeah, it's a weird one for me because I'm trying to think of what. I mean, realistically, it would be, you know, the same kind of idea of like world rankings, right? So it's like if someone is in contention at a tournament and they're ranked 250th in the world, you're gonna be like, what the heck is going on? This is nuts. But with the B pool, it's just so weird because, again, how ratings work, you know, I don't want to call anyone out, but sometimes when you see players have high ratings and then they come to a tour event or they play on tour, their scores or their rating, I guess, for that tournament don't match up anywhere near what their actual rating is. And so I don't really like that idea of like comparing like the B pool because it's just a ratings thing, right? So like Tristan Tanner, even though he's rated however he is, like I know his ceiling because I've played with him before. His ceiling is as high as anyone else on tour. Whereas there's other people that have the same exact rating as he is that their ceiling is like, you know, they're in this range. They're never going to pop off, but they're never going to actually have a blow up. And that's where I think like having a better world ranking system or something like that, I think that tells more of a story than someone's rating. But it'll be interesting to see kind of how this goes because obviously I don't think the Disc Golf Network, from what I heard from social media and other people and some of the posts I saw, I don't think the Disc Golf Network did that great of a job of really telling the story. It almost seemed like sometimes it was almost this notion of like, well, they haven't played the same courses yet, so like let's figure it out. And it's like, do you know how hard it is to shoot 13 under at Country Club? I'll tell you right now, no one else beat that score all tournament. That's how hard it is.
Yeah, they did. They mentioned it as like when they got to the Country Club, that's the score. Like people were chasing that score and stuff like that. But no, they definitely, he was not treated as the true lead.
Correct.
After round
one. Even after round two, right? Wasn't he still in the lead after round two?
Could have been. He was definitely still in contention. He wasn't treated in contention until I think after round three.
Until there was actually
until he'd actually played.
Yeah, they merged the Which is
then he was treated as in contention.
Which is crazy to me because again, it's like we're playing the same courses now. Obviously, if one let's say it was really my scenario of how like the B and A pool wouldn't work is if there was a open course and a wooded course. And the B pool played the open course in no wind, and the A pool was playing the wooded course in no wind. And then the next day happened, and it was really windy, and you got to play in the woods in the wind, and the other people had to play out in the open. I can see how there you can be like, well, let's just wait and see what happens when they kind of get together because conditions are way harder. There was one or two days where the wind was up a little bit, maybe 3 or 4 miles per hour heavier than the previous ones. But like every day was pretty much the same. You know, maybe a stroke here, maybe a stroke there, but I don't know. I just thought it was interesting, especially on the social media side. I know they maybe talked about it more on live coverage and you would know that more than me. But I think on the social media side, they were showing like scoreboards and stuff sometimes where like his name wasn't on there. It was like it was like saying the leaders were T2, and people were like, "Well, where the heck is T1? Where's one?"
Well, they were pulling that from UDisc because it was super confusing to watch on UDisc because you had round
that was
one.
They got to figure that out.
They had the pool split.
They got to figure out UDisc. UDisc was so confusing.
Well, because then even when the pools merged, had like Tristan Tanner's score updating from what he was doing on round one, but it was saying like he was finished.
Because it was on ECC.
Because I thought when I looked at UDisc day two, I was thinking, because it said finish next to his name, I was thinking he's done with his round. I'm like, oh, he shot even at Jones. Like, he's about to get ran over. And then his score, like, slowly started changing. I was like, what's going on? Then I went to Jones, and you had to, like, scroll to find him, because at Jones, it was a weird scenario.
Hopefully they can figure out the system. And this is what I'll say, too. I think I said this on the previous podcast. The only reason I think we're playing two tournaments, at least at this turn, at this Worlds, because the courses are so similar, the only reason is because they want to have as many players as they can to, I guess, increase the purse. Is what I'm assuming the reasoning is behind.
Well, that's
it.
We've done the math before, and I'd have to look at it again, but increasing the amount of players in the tournament increases the total purse, but doesn't change the payout.
Well, it would increase the amount of people that got paid out, right? So I think it's like the Correct. Cut was like with 200 plus players, the cut was what, 80, 70 something?
70 something,
yeah. Where if you only had like the 100 top players in the world and you still had a 40%
it's
cut,
like
40 players. So like that changes, but yes, this if you want the winner to be $20,000, you don't need to have 200 people in your event to make the winner.
Yeah, it's the added cash.
Correct.
That does it.
Yeah,
yeah. Which I mean, it's cool to see 20,000 MPO, 11,000 FPO. I believe it was good to see a very big payout for the World Championship because I think that's how it should be. But yeah, the B pool. It definitely made things confusing because I think that's where they were pulling their data from UDisc. They're pulling it just from the Jones Supreme. Mm-hmm. So that's why, like, on Jones Supreme, the numbers were right. They were tied second, but it was just leaving out Tristan. And I believe there's one other person who was a little bit farther down from the B pool. He ended up finishing like 20th or something. But definitely, like, it was confusing to say the least. Once you figured it out and understood it, you knew what was going on, but like looking at it, you couldn't just look at the leaderboard and know what was happening. And like I said, on coverage and it seems like in social media, it wasn't really treated as the true lead until after round three. Then they were treated as like, oh, he's actually still. And I mean, I was one of the people. I was like, this, I mean, it doesn't matter. This guy just played in the B pool. Like, he just played. Because the other thing is, we didn't know how hard or easy Emporia Country Club was going to play because we hadn't seen it since DDO. So when he shot 13, it wasn't unreasonable to think, oh, well, the A pool's going to go over there in 13. Like, that's the score.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to be easy for someone to shoot.
The way I view the two courses as far as difficulty goes, I think if you had to, you know, because with disc golf, it's different than golf. You have to look at it a different way. So I look at it as how difficult is it to birdie? Because there might be a hole that's really hard to birdie, but is not very hard to par. Like to play, to get a par on it, not very difficult, but to birdie it, extremely difficult. And then there's other holes that it might be extremely difficult to birdie, but it's also easy to get a bogey or a double. So I think Jones had more holes that were difficult to birdie, but the majority of their holes out there, you weren't going to take really big numbers. Where Country Club had maybe only one, I'm trying to think, I think 14 or sorry, 12 and 9 were probably the only two holes at Country Club that were difficult to birdie, but they had so many more holes where you could take big numbers. So to me, if you were on and you were playing well, it was probably easier to score at Country Club than Jones. But if you were off and you were struggling with finding the fairways and stuff, you were probably going to score better at Jones than Country Club, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, well, it was evident in the field because you went after you'd played Jones twice and you at that time had played Country Club once. The field was a jumbled mess still. There was like 25 people that you could argue were in contention. Once you played Emporia one more time, the Country Club another time, that started to become less true going into the final round. So like you could see the separation start to happen the more you played Country Club, whereas Jones, it was more of a stay in the mix. Country Club was actually gain strokes.
Yeah, and surprisingly, like, you know, playing these courses without win, these were pretty much birdie or die courses. You know, coming off of Northwoods, which is arguably one of the more difficult courses that we play on tour, if you par a hole, you're not super upset. Every par, bogey, double bogey I took, I was getting more and more frustrated because of just how easy the courses were playing. It unfortunately were these birdie or die courses. So it's like you would You would make a par and you'd just be so mad. You would get so frustrating. And so it made, for a lot of people, it made for a very, very long week, myself included.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, one thing while we're still talking about the courses that we talked about last week, I think we can bring up now, and I really wish Silas was here because he defended the Jones starting hole.
Yeah, what the heck was that? Why didn't he say anything during our podcast? He didn't bring it up at all.
I don't know. I brought it up to him the next day at work. I was like, Silas, what are you thinking? The Jones starting hole. He's like, it's a great starting hole. He said, and I asked him, I was like, so hole 16 at Emporia, that'd be a great starting hole? He's like, yeah, that'd be thrilling. I'm like, no, Silas. But yeah, I wish he was here to so we could pick his brain on what's going on in there, because it can't be too much. But the Jones starting hole played out essentially how
exactly there is one exactly how we explained it exactly,
and most people agreed. Most people, when they were watching it, I was getting tweeted at, being like, yeah, like I didn't, they said going into the tournament I didn't understand what you guys were saying, I thought you were stupid. Then I watched it and I was like, makes perfect sense, especially when you saw Eagle lay up, he threw like a 90 foot shot. Like it was like someone went OB.
No,
I think one person made the island.
No, all three people went OB. All three people went OB. Then Eagle stepped up and laid up. And that was literally, we're not dumb over here, okay? Sometimes we might say ridiculous things, but a lot of time we are spot on. And this was one of those instances we were spot on. And my whole thing was, you want to get players like off and running in golf, hitting a golf shot is exciting. The noise. I was just watching it the other day. I was watching some random Instagram on my it's not For You page, but whatever
the Explore page.
I was just watching some random dude hit a golf ball, and I was fascinated with it just because of the sound. The sound a ball makes when it hits a club is an incredible sound. They have that going for them. We don't have that in disc golf. There is no incredible, unless you're like the Drew Gibsons of the world, where you have that crazy snap, which is a very minority of people that hold the disc a certain way that you get that snap. We don't really have any sort of like coolness of when you throw. So we're all about how far a disc goes and how long it's in the air for and the flight. Like those are the things that really bring excitement off the first tee. And I get what Silas is saying is like the pressure of trying to make the island at hole one or trying to make the island at hole 16 at a country club. Like I get the lead up, but it is the worst way to start a tournament because what happened happens. First person goes up.
Yeah.
First person goes up. Everyone clapping. Woo! Let's go. OB. You can't clap.
Dead silent.
You can't clap. Yeah. Second guy, same thing. Woo! OB. Third guy, the woos are getting a little quieter because it's getting a little bit ominous. He goes OB. Then Eagle gets called up. He lays up. You're supposed to cheer for a 90-foot putt, like a little putt thing on a par three? That makes no sense. It's the worst way to start a tournament. And from a player standpoint, no one likes it. No player... I'll say this. No player will come out and actually defend that as being a good starting hole unless they just want to be different. Everyone wants to play ECC, that hole, of where you're just bombing a shot on hole one. Like,
yeah. Well, what's good about the Emporia Country Club is there's still the separation. Like, that separation you get from the island hole, that still happens somewhat on hole one.
Well, yeah, it happens a lot. People take bogeys and doubles on that hole.
This next few shots are tough.
Well, the first shot's tough. The first shot is tough.
It can be.
No,
we didn't see many people mess it up.
The first shot is tough, Hunter. Like, I saw plenty. Like,
I'm sure I would mess it up.
Well, you also, when you're watching, you're only seeing the best players, right? Because at that point in time, you're seeing lead card. People like myself that teed off a little earlier in the day, I got to see people tee off before me as well, like in the groups before me.
Yeah.
You don't realize those trees over on the right, if you're trying to throw the hyzer, like the safe hyzer play, those trees over on the right, because you don't want to throw it too high to where it could go all the way across OB left, those trees come into play. And people throw shots into those trees and get 250 feet off the tee pad. So it is a very It is still a demanding shot, and I think some people kind of misunderstood what my point was. My point was we should have the first hole just be like a wide open shot where people are just throwing 360 max distance shots, and they don't like. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying give us a full shot. Let us throw a full shot on the first hole.
Even we saw it might have been Paige went OB. Someone went OB. Left, I believe. Mm-hmm. But you could hear the crowd because the person, whoever it was, got aggressive. So, like, there was a full flex shot happening and stuff like that, and you could hear the crowd start to root and cheer for the disc to stay in bounds. And there was at least something to root for there. Mm-hmm. Versus hole one at Jones Supreme, it's either, like you said, layup eagle, boring, or you go for it, and, like, there might be some, like, little dancing, but it was basically, like, you hit the island and stayed, or you never were close to the island. Was the two shots I saw, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was, every once in a while, there's one that, like, Heiser just shy, and it was like, oh. But in Emporia, at least you saw the disc fly. And I think that, in Emporia, I think that was the important thing. And then the hole got tougher as you went down, too, getting closer to the green, where there was still the stroke separation that people were saying of hole one, of, like, that's why it's so exciting, was the pressure. There's plenty of pressure at Emporia Country Club. It was just, you got to see the disc fly. I think that's crucial right off the tee.
We'll see what the people think. I mean, they were able to watch it and see it firsthand, and we'll see if we've changed anyone's minds on starting holes.
Yeah, I mean, and again, hole one, because that's the other thing, is hole one is not a bad hole.
No.
It's just a bad hole.
It'd be an incredible hole 17 at Jones.
Yeah, exactly. You step up to that with that type of pressure, and, like, you know, if it was Paul and Aaron going into that hole versus hole 16 at Emporia Country Club, very similar, like, vibe, where you get to hole 16, it's like, okay, you got to get through this hole, just like hole 17 at USDGC. Late in the round, that type of pressure is incredible, because then it's not awkward when someone misses the island, but on the first hole when someone misses it, it also, like, it's got to be weird as a player, miss it and then hear the crowd, like, go silent, and it, like, amplifies what's going on in your head on top of it. Like, you're already dealing with, oh, I missed the island, but then you have that awkward walk, like the walk of shame off the tee pad back to your bag.
Yeah, right,
and,
when,
like, everyone's just staring at you dead
right
silent
at the start of the round. Yeah, it's
that's got to be a mental.
People want to get excited on hole one, and I think how Country Club does it on hole 16 is phenomenal, because you have the par five that is now kind of gettable. I guess a couple people got the eagle. A couple people had eagle looks on 14. Mm-hmm. Then 15 is just your standard kind of stock hyzer 430-foot shot. And then you walk past the island. I don't know if you knew that, or if they were able to convey that.
I knew
that.
It, but I think it's because I'd been there.
Yeah, I don't know if you're
I don't know if they showed it.
I don't know if you're able to convey it, but basically how it works is hole 15 is going in the opposite direction of hole 16. So 16's green is literally parallel with 15's green. So when you finish hole 15, you literally walk over to the same sidewalk that you walked down hole 16, and you walk back up. So you essentially are walking by all the water the whole time. If you look over to your right, you're seeing it. And then you loop around and you get to it. I think that's an incredible design, to where you're having to see it. It's very similar to TPC Sawgrass, if you guys are familiar with the Players Championship. Very similar design to hole 16 and hole 17 out there, of where hole 16 plays alongside 17. So while you're playing 16, if you just for a half second, take a look over to your right, you can see what's looming ahead of you. And I think that mind games, I think all of that does wonders. And I think it's great.
How did you, as a player, feel with, like, the line being off the water on the island on 16 in Emporia Country Club?
I might have been the reason for that, because at DDO, if you remember, I think it was final round DDO, my disc, like, just, like, shoot, like, just launched. And so essentially, it was one of those weird ones of where it was in the water, but the disc got through the mud so much that it, like, was the tip of the disc, or, like, you know, the edge of the disc, if you will, was, like, in the land, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
My whole thing is, unless there is a defined line, unless there's a very, like, even concrete and grass. We had this issue on at Jones hole two that I had to like bring up to one of the officials. The street and grass was not super defined because there was like some concrete or some cement. What's a street made out of? Is it made out of cement?
Asphalt.
Is it asphalt? There was like some spots of where like you could see it kind of like overflowed into the grass. And so at that point you're like, is that a part of the street or not? Like it's on asphalt, but it's like clear.
Yeah.
To my whole thing, like I think there should all around water, there should always be lines because we had one close call of where someone threw a hyzer and it kind of came in right on the line. And so essentially what ended up happening was like his disc like brushed over green grass onto the line type of thing. And so like looking at it, you're like, well, yeah, you're on green grass, but I think that's just the grass that you've like bent over. That's the closest call you'll ever get on lines. But when there's water, there's so much room for like, well, I think like I'm kind of on, just have a line, just paint a line. And then that way it's so much quicker, so much easier. That situation, we never saw anyone have to like, or at least I never saw anyone have to like go up to the island to see if they were in or out. It was pretty clear whether or not they had made it. And when there's water involved, it's just so hard to tell if a little, you know, piece of your disc is over land or not. So I don't mind it. Yeah. I don't mind it at all. I don't think it played harder because I think the water was very down compared to what it was at DDO. The island itself was the same size as it was at DDO. So I didn't mind it. I think it made it easier too for viewers to see whether or not you're in or not.
Well, the only thing was it would first time through coverage, every time through coverage, didn't matter. You know, I didn't even notice the line was off the water until Aaron threw in the playoff and he was OB but on green grass. That's when people started bringing it up. Is they're like, oh, that sucks for him. He should be safe. He's on grass. But I see, like, I fully get because, like, it also could have been a very – you'd rather it be a clear call where he's on grass, but he knows where the OB is. Everyone did. You'd rather it be a clear call there than – it's in the water, like your situation. Correct. But now you're in a playoff for the world championship. And it's like, how do you expect someone to make that call? Because whichever this call, you can argue, oh, the line shouldn't have been there, but the line was there where everyone knew where it was. Yeah. It was a very defined thing. You can't argue he should have been in, should have been out. The disc being in the water, then it could have created a whole different argument of Aaron might have actually got screwed by his disc being in or out. It's a very muddy line.
Were they using old drone footage? Were they using sometimes drone footage from DDO?
Yeah, because the grass was like all dead.
And like there's no leaves on trees.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was very obvious.
Because there was no line at DDO. Yeah, there was no line at DDO. So
I don't really think they showed. I could be wrong. I don't remember them like using a drone footage for 16. Hole 16. Okay. Because they had a camera on 16 all day, so by the time the lead card got there, you had seen several shots on 16 throughout the day already.
Gotcha.
So you kind of knew what was coming.
Okay.
Because they had, I think you could actually have watched.
Yeah, they did that.
Just hole 16, if you wanted.
Yeah, that. So I think they're getting closer and closer to the model that I was talking about a long time ago of where like just have a couple cameras posted up. And you literally can just, you know, heck, you don't even need to literally have a camera operator on a lot of them, right? You literally just have it posted and then you can have that footage to come back to where there's not so many commercials or so many like down points. But that's cool that they had those featured things. And I think eventually it's going to get to the point too of where the live broadcast is completely different than featured, right? So if you want to watch feature card, you can literally watch the feature card and that's just going to be shots from them. But the live coverage is going to be everything. It's going to be telling the whole story. So we're getting closer and closer to that. But that was cool that they busted it out for there because obviously I'm sure some people probably just wanted to be like, oh, let me see what's going on at 16. Let me watch some shots. Or you could just go over there without nothing was happening.
Yeah. Well, you could also look at like, oh, Brody's on hole 15. I'm going to hop over to 16 and see how he plays it.
That's cool.
I know. I think Jordan Castro tweeted, someone tweeted where they had, like, their family was watching it. And then also the ace, you're able to have footage from aces and stuff like that. Because they did it at USDGC. I believe they had hole 7 and hole 17.
Mm.
Where both of them were available, where you could watch, because they are both just exciting par threes. You need one camera to cover it. Super easy. Hole 7 at USDGC, I actually saw the camera. It was literally just strapped to the fence, and it was no camera operator. It was just sitting, shooting back through the Mando, so that if an ace happened, they had it. Hole 17, they had a camera operator on, because they could get 17 and 18 kind of throughout the day.
Oh, they can whip back and forth. That's smart.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely think that's a smart investment, because a lot of courses have that. Like hole 8 at Maple Hill would be a great one. A lot of courses have a hole like that, where it's just something exciting to cut through throughout the day, and it's like, hey, everyone's just walking right now, or the only shot we have is of someone who's blown up and is in 40th place. Let's just go to an exciting shot on the island,
yeah,
or something like that. Now, you mentioned previously before we started the stream something about Katrina Allen's lost disc. I think I remember seeing a tweet about it.
Yeah.
But walk us through what you're talking about.
So essentially, this was on hole 16 at Jones, and to kind of the easiest way of knowing what hole that is, it's the one where there you have the American flag, like the flagpole,
yeah,
that you're trying to throw up. Now, that hole plays extremely difficult for FPO because it plays as a par 5, but they're having to throw their second shot onto that like skinny green grass with all the trees on the right. Where MPO, we're basically just throwing a hyzer into the landing zone, and then we're throwing across all the OB. FPO is playing like basically two shots and then throwing across. So it was on Katrina's second throw, and playing that hole with Ezra and having one of his discs go into that tall junk mess, that stuff is literally impossible to find a disc, and also you don't want to be in there. So many thorns. It is a nightmare, which is a different question of like, should that be part of courses? Should we have areas where it's like literally impossible to walk through, or should we have just like tall grass? But beside that point, she ends up throwing into there. On live coverage, you can see kind of exactly where the disc ended up going, and they were just not looking in the right direction. They were looking like 30 or 40 feet shorter, and the whole kind of debate over it was like whether or not it was a lost disc, and how Katrina handled it, I thought was the correct way of handling it. I probably would have done the same exact way. Like, if you see a disc go OB, you don't need to find that disc. It is not a lost disc. Like, if you see it go OB, hence, if that was water and you saw the disc go into the water and you're like, it crossed here and went into the water, you don't need to go diving into the water to make sure the disc is actually in there. And I don't know exactly. I'm sure there's probably more information on it somewhere. I didn't really dig too much into it, but I know there was some sort of like debate going on with either a PDGA official or someone, to where she essentially had like marked her lie, and the group, I guess, had, or I'm not sure if the entire group or a couple people in her group had said, yes, that's fine, take it there. But as she was like basically almost about to start her run up, someone had like said something to be like, hey, I don't think this is right, or are you sure, yada yada, which obviously kind of upset her a little bit. But I thought that was an interesting thing. I don't know if that's ever been brought up before, of where you saw the disc but you weren't able to find it.
I just had to look at the technical rule.
Yeah, I didn't know if this was like a weird PGA thing of where it's like,
because you're right on water, but some part of me feels like on land you're supposed to find it.
Yeah, see, that's really interesting, because like to me it's like, if I just threw a disc in there and I don't really care about that disc at all, I'm not going in there to try to get it. Like, that's how bad it was.
Where there's been several times in tournaments. I actually thought you were going to say something else about it, but I'll bring that up in a second. There's been several times in tournaments that I've played in where we've seen a disc clearly go OB, no doubt about it. We know where it went OB. We get up there. The player is like, I'm good here, marks it, throws. We walk down the fairway. Then he goes and looks for his disc.
That's also,
I don't even know if he ever found his disc.
That's also pace of play wise. It's probably the best way of doing it. So that way you're not holding up pace of play.
Because it would be interesting if like we all went and looked for it and we're like, hey, we can't find it. 3 minutes is up. Because that's a drastic difference of you're taking it where it went out right here, or hey, march yourself back 300 feet. But what I thought you were about to bring up was I saw, I think it was Dana Vici tweeted, because I think I was running while this happened. I was doing something that I wasn't watching coverage, and I just pulled up my phone and looked at Twitter. And Dana Vici said, did we really just hear Elaine tell Terry where to look for a lost disc? I think it was about the situation, because I think on live coverage they knew about where it went.
Interesting.
And Elaine was like, Terry, I think they need to look a little bit farther this way. And Dana was like, that's not allowed. Now, obviously, it sounds like they didn't end up finding it, but that's something where...
That's wild. That's wild. Yeah. If you're trying to find a lost disc and someone like on coverage is like, no, you got to look this way, and then they end up finding it.
Yeah. Because that's the same... I mean, it's the same thing that happened with Elaine with Kristen's child at Champions Cup. She's just trying to help.
Yeah.
At the moment, she's not thinking... She doesn't have some alternative motive or whatever it's called, where she's like trying to be spiteful and go against the rules. Because you could see where... I could see if I'm watching this on coverage,
like, oh, that's,
and I'm sitting
10
here,
feet that way.
Like, oh my gosh, guys, y'all are in the, like, you got to walk 50 feet farther forward. You're just not even close to it. Mm. I could see that. And if you have like Terry, you're in Terry's ear and you're just like, Terry, tell him just to walk 50 feet farther. They're looking the wrong area. You could see where you'd easily do that. But obviously that can't happen because that the card behind you doesn't have that advantage. The card in front of you might not have that advantage. Like, no one else is going to have that same advantage of seeing exactly where a disc goes in. But it also brings in a question of, like, should the chase cam on Jomez be able to help you find a lost disc?
Yeah, so this is where I think the solution to this, because right now what we're all suggesting and stuff is not good things, right? Like, just because you're on Jomez or on Chase Card or Live or whatever doesn't mean you should have the advantage of having someone be able to tell you exactly where your disc is. And other people potentially have to, you know, potentially might have a lost disc because they don't have that. So this is where I'm like, hey, if you are in the town or nearby to one of the tournaments and you want to volunteer, all the pros greatly, greatly appreciate every spotter that is out there.
Absolutely.
I think it's a huge, huge thing, not only for the pros, obviously, on an individual standpoint, but for the fairness of a tournament, to have someone that is down there specifically looking for discs and being able to be like, yep, and then walks over, puts a flag exactly where your disc is. That mm-hmm. is, one, so good for pace of play. And two, obviously, I think it, like you're saying, it makes it to where it's way more fair, because if I'm playing at 10:30 in the morning and I have no one watching me, and I throw this blind shot up and around and we get up there to try to figure out where it is, and we didn't know that it hit this tree and ricocheted off 40 feet that way, like, I have a huge disadvantage compared to someone that maybe has 100 people watching their card and they've got 35 people all trying to help them find the disc. So I'm not saying one's right and one's wrong. They're both in the rules, right? You are allowed to have spectators and stuff help try to locate a disc. So there's not one right or wrong, but I would just say to like equal the playing field and make it fair across the board, this is where I think spotters, the value of spotters is unbelievable. It is so helpful.
Yeah, because where the line was confusing here was that it was camera footage being used, and that is against PDJ rules.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
It's weird because it's live footage, so it's not like you're going and like looking at a picture of am I in or out type thing. But in my head, the easiest first step solution is media members do not help with lost discs, stuff like that. Because like if you are on third card and you have 50 people watching you, you know, and Chase Card had, or I guess we'll go like fifth card and fourth card, you have like 50 people watching you. Is it an advantage? Yes, absolutely, to have 50 people watching and help you look. But it's an earned advantage to a certain extent. You know what I'm saying? So that's one thing versus Which I guess you could say the coverage is an earned advantage too. I don't know, but I just think it's a weirder look for a spectator looking for a disc versus official media for the tournament looking for a disc is a weird look.
This is where disc golf is still small, right? This is disc golf is still small to where pros are friends and hang out and know who the people that are filming them. That is not the case in other sports. You would never see some sideline guy on an NFL camera like put their camera down for a second and start up a conversation with one of the players. Like it would be a very rare thing to see, where you probably see it every single time on coverage. Someone on Jomez, someone on live is like talking to players. It's again one of those where it's just disc golf is small, and eventually it will kind of grow out of that stage of where, like you said, like you would never, the camera operator is never thinking, I need to have a conversation with this person, or I need to put my camera down and help find their disc. Like they're there for a job, which is literally covering the event, and that's what they should be doing the entire time. And I think eventually it'll get to that point. But right now it's just weird because everyone's kind of intermingling, right? Jomez does a bunch of stuff off of live coverage, so you have relationships with their staff as well. So there is this kind of like already like, hey man, what's going on? Good to see you. Like I think that all changes as the sport gets bigger and bigger, obviously.
Yeah, because the commentary one, obviously this would be taking it to a very big extreme. But if you go to the core of it, similar idea. If you're watching an NFL game and Tony Romo knows exactly what's about to happen, you know, and he's watching it and he tells the sideline reporter, hey, go tell the head coach they're about to do this. That one's clear, not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right? Very extreme version of essentially what happened where it's like, hey, Terry, they're in the wrong place. They got to go farther forward because you have this third perspective where you're like broke through and you're like, oh, I have this wide angle. I know exactly where it's at. Hey, sideline reporter, go tell and directly affect what's going on in the game.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, as the sport grows and stuff like that, roles are defined more, it won't happen. But it was interesting. One side of the sport growing that I think is pretty exciting, it was questionable at times, but pretty exciting, was the win percentage that was introduced by UDisc. Now, we can say it's questionable all we want. I saw a lot of people on social media saying it. It ended up being accurate. So how questionable could it really be?
So this is what I'll say on it. Statistics is a good thing. You need more stuff to talk about, especially for this. If you threw me into a commentary booth right now, and it would be so hard for me to be able to do a good job simply just on the fact of like, there's really not that much to talk about, right? You're only seeing a handful of players. And if you're a lot of times when you listen to commentary in other sports, they are constantly spitting out facts of things that have happened in the past, things that are projected in the future. And, you know, some of that is their own homework coming into the broadcast with that. But a lot of times that stuff is, you know, there's teams of people coming up with statistics and stuff as the event's happening that are feeding those in. So this win percentage, the fact that it's in this algorithm that it's in and it's constantly updating, this is an incredible thing, I think, for the Pro Tour and the Disc Golf Network to be able to use during coverage. And yes, obviously, was it insane that Tristan Tanner had like less than a 1% chance of winning after being in the lead for like by 2 strokes after day one? Yeah, like that. We were basically talking about...
He didn't win, though.
Okay, yeah. It's the same notion of the Amanda Nunes fight with Juliana Pena. Juliana Pena, had one of the worst odds ever to win that fight. And guess what? She won it. So it's like, the whole win percentage, if it was, around betting, which most win percentages in other sports are going to be around betting...
Yeah.
You're not putting – there's no – like, what's that line for Tristan Tanner? Plus 10,000? Plus 15,000? Like, there's going to be a lot of action on that line. Like, the dude's in the lead.
Mm-hmm.
I can put $10 down to win $1,000 or something. Sure, why not? Like, so that's why I think some of the win percentages probably were way too much heavily on like, what have you done lately, right? Because you would see, I think on the FPO side, I want to say like Henna, I don't know if she was tied with Kristen or...
At one point she was, yeah.
Yeah, and like her win percentage was so much lower. And I think it's just one of those where however the algorithm is set up, it just has so much more weight in what have you done and not as much weight of like, how are you playing this week? So, like going into Worlds, if you were like, hey, Tristan has a less than 1% chance of winning, I would be like, okay, that's fine. That's not crazy. But after him having a lead after round one, you're telling me he has less than 1% chance? That's where it's like, that seems off. But I think overall, it's a good thing. It's something that you can talk about. It's something that you can pay attention to and watch. And it was definitely cool and interesting to kind of see the ups and flows, especially on the FPO side. Like I said, I don't really pay attention too much on the MPO side because I'm playing most of the time. But on the FPO side, it was cool to kind of bounce on. You'd see someone like get a double bogey and they went from 9% chance to win to like 6. So like it was cool to see. It's a cool feature.
I was trying to find I tweeted one cuz I thought it was very funny. I might have to go to my Twitter. The win percentage was, I think it was Henna when she was tied for the lead.
Oh jeez.
Was it Ella Hansen? Or no.
And like Paige had like 5 shots off the lead and she had like a higher win percentage.
And had a better chance. Yeah. Let me find. I definitely tweeted the picture. Come on.
Because as much as you want to say.
Here it is.
Oh, go ahead.
Ella Hansen tied for the lead late in round two. UDisc. Yeah, she's got no shot. So it was late in round two. She was at 13 under and she had a 2% chance of winning. So she was tied for the lead deep into round two. 5-round tournament, but still, I would have expected that to be like 10%, something like that. I don't know. I'm not a statistician, so again, everything they put on there was right.
Well,
because like as the week went on,
you can say that and you can't because like you know you look at like Paige for example, right? Like Paige had a super high percentage of winning at some points,
but it slowly went down as the week went on.
Well, I mean, yeah, but like, what was her top five? Was it top five or top three?
They had both on there.
Did they have both on there?
No. They had top five, top 10.
Did they have top 10?
They had top 10 for sure.
I think they only had...
I have a screenshot.
Show me what the screenshot said. I thought there was just two. I thought it was win percentage and then one something else.
Top five. I think on computer it showed you a third.
Okay. What did it show you?
So it's win top five.
Okay. So like you can also look at that and say they weren't really right on that because like Paige's top 5% was like in the 90s.
She came in fifth.
Did she come in fifth?
You make me question everything. I know Kat came in like 11th, but I think Paige came in
5th. I don't think Kat's top 5 was ever that high, though. Fact check me. See.
I'm looking at it.
If she came in 5th, then the system is 100% right, and we have no qualms. We can't argue the system. They were right about everything.
I completely was wrong. Paige came in 11th. Kat came in like 20-something.
Okay, so now... Okay.
Yep. I was right. Paige came in 5th. Kat came in 11th. I was looking after round 1.
Oh.
Paige came in 5th.
Oh, okay. So then the system's right. System's right.
That's what I'm saying. It was 100% accurate. 100% accurate. Can't argue
So if you enter a tournament and you have a less than 1% chance of winning, you should just not show up.
No, you still have that chance. You still have that one less than 1% chance. You could be the 1 in a million. Because it even like slowly upped Aaron Gossage's percent chance of winning to win. I think the playoff that had him at 50-50 finally.
That's cool.
But as it went on, you know, obviously, because I mean, obviously going into that final round, you expected Paul to win because Aaron, especially after he missed the putt on hole one, which I told Silas he was going to miss.
How close
pressure,
was it?
You just expected it. Like, it was for birdie. It was like 15, 20 feet. Clanked it out. He clanked 3 that he was making all week off the front cage. On 16, hole 1, and there's one other one that all 3 of them were like, ah. And so he had plenty of shots to do it, and he fluffed the upshot. Not fluffed. He actually crushed it long right on 17.
His upshot on 17 was bad. Yeah,
because Paul put the pressure on throwing a bad drive, then pretty insane second shot. Aaron got way up there with his drive.
I don't know if he really put the pressure. I mean, the second shot that Paul had on 17 was ridiculous. I don't know if that really changes.
Aaron should have got up and down either way.
Yeah, I don't think that really put the pressure on him because no one's expecting Paul to make that 65 footer or whatever. So,
But he was able to hold on 18 though and get up and down in a crucial moment. Yeah, and have a lot of pressure.
I don't think people realize how ridiculous of an upshot that is on 18. That is not like there are four other shots I would throw before that one.
it makes sense.
Like the Spike Heiser forehand is like a.
It's not on your list.
No, if you see someone doing that, you're like, this guy has no idea how to play disc golf. Like that is not. Yeah. So the fact that he like not only executed it, but stoned it like that. I mean, that's insane under those conditions too. So.
Yeah, I was very impressed with him all weekend, but I do think a big part of it was the courses played very well to his play style. Just both the courses were. The two courses were too complementary of each other, in my opinion.
And he putted well, right? Like, I mean,
he putted very well.
This is something that this will be actually something that's again. Unfortunately, I love UDIS stats and stuff. Unfortunately, a lot of times the people that are doing the stats aren't necessarily always in the best spot, and like they'll kind of you can't look at the stats as much as I wish you could look at the stats to be like, oh. These are 100% facts, you know? And like we talked about too, you know, you might have someone that throws it into circle two 20 times in a round, but 15 of those times are 55 feet. So like their circle two putting percentage is going to be a lot worse. But it gives you at least a decent gist of what you're looking at. And I think the big ones at these courses, the two things I think you're going to see the best. Sorry, the two things that are like the big key. What am I trying to say? The two stats that you're probably going to see to make the most difference is OB rate, right? I think that's number one. If you keep the disc in bounds at these two courses, you're probably going to shoot up the leaderboard. And then the other one would probably be like strokes gained putting would be what I would say. So
that makes sense.
Paul, for example, was fourth in OB rate and 22nd in strokes gained putting. And Gossage was first in OB rate and 85th in strokes gained putting. So
that surprises me that he's that far down in putting. Because he missed some that he should have made for sure. But he was making.
Well, he also has no he has no UDIS stats from round one, and like I said, there could be a lot. This is where it's one of those weird things too. Is just like the percentages. You know, you have a couple that were 35 feet that they're counting as 32 or whatever. It makes a little dicey. But like he made. Go ahead.
Imagine if we had a world champion that had and they just had like no stats from his first round. Because, like, he's just...
We didn't have stats for the first six holes of round one. Does anyone...
I was trying to follow it.
They're like, does anyone want to do UDIS? We're like, no. What the heck? Like, doing scores for everyone is enough of, like, an annoyance.
Yeah, you don't want to have to go sit there and be like, fairway.
Yeah, we're like... I literally looked at everyone. And I was like, does anyone care about UDIS stats? And they're like, no. And I was like, all right, we're good. And then they got word out that we didn't have it and there was enough complaint that they sent someone out to start doing it on like hole six or something. But
that makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, but yeah, OB rate was like the number one. To me, that's the number one decider. I'd be shocked if anyone that was like that finished well.
What
like
did Paul lead in?
Circle two percentage. And OB rate. He was fourth in OB rate. He only threw...
Circle two percentages in, like, hitting circle two with looks or making putts in circle
no,
two?
No, hitting it. He was 84% in circle two. And again, you're going the numbers for circle two and circle one in regulation are going to be so high for the people that don't throw OB. Like...
Yeah.
The only time... you're really struggling to get in to get a birdie look at any of these courses is when you throw OB. Like if you don't throw OB, you're getting tons and tons of birdie looks. So he had 84% of the holes, which if we do the math real quick, you do 18 times 5 and 84% of that, 75 holes. He had a birdie look at for 75 holes. He had a birdie look, and he shot 45 under.
That was a little higher.
So he probably had a handful of bogeys. So like, you know,
46.
So that, you know, that just showed he probably bogeyed. I don't know. So he probably out of those 75 attempts, he probably made 55 of them or something like that. 50 something. So
probably. That
to me, like these two courses, that was the thing. Like just throw the disc in bounds. If you don't throw the disc out of bounds, you're Gucci.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Which is surprising. I thought putting would have had a bigger impact. I thought so.
But it's just getting yourself looks.
But like Tristan Tanner on the opposite end, he threw OB more, right? So he was 32nd. He threw it 12 OB shots, which was 8 more than Gossage, 6 more than Paul. But he putted way better. He was 7th in gain putting. So I still think those two like obviously matter the most.
You needed one or the other, it seems.
Yeah. You're not going to find someone – I love looking at – I wish these statistics were so much better because then it's like you actually could look at them. Chris Clemens, 4 OB shots. He got 4th. You know? Don't ask me how many times I threw OB. I threw OB more in this tournament than I did at DDO.
Wow. Now there's a stat.
By 4. I think I had
you
4.
You need the wind.
I think I had 4 more OB shots this tournament than I did at DDO.
There's one extra round here, right?
But we're also playing in 25 mile per hour less wind.
Nah, well, you know, just don't tell people that. Just say you played one more round, a few more OB shots, you know. Tougher tournament.
I mean, there were people that are throwing like OB 30 times at DDO.
Yeah.
That's how windy it was. So, yeah, that's a fun stat.
So now world is over. Most players are getting into postseason mentality, going to GMC, MVP, Tour Championship. A lot of people's eyes are turning to the Tour Championship, trying to make the cut there. Obviously, USDGC is in the mix there. But there's the Silver Series this weekend.
Yeah.
Which you were technically registered for. I think you still are technically registered for. But
I didn't drop out of that. What the heck?
You might have already dropped out. I don't know. I know yesterday you were on the list still. Walk us through the decision, which it seems like a pretty obvious one, why you're not playing that, and then
points.
Why some people are.
Points.
So basically you think people who are showing up to it need points.
Or money.
I mean, as of yesterday, I'll look at it again. Ricky was showing up. There's a few other guys that I was like, what are we doing there?
Well, so this is the reason. Okay, first off, for me, points is literally why I go to tournaments.
Yeah. Ricky dropped since I said that.
Okay. And if you look at this tournament, I've played enough Silver Series already to count as many as I can. So it would have to overtake my worst performing Silver Series that counts currently, which I don't know. I think I have like 10 points or something, 8 or 9 points, I think is my worst one. So if I won this event, the most points I would get is like 14, mm-hmm. which in the grand scheme of things is not anywhere near how many points are up on the table at GMC and MVP. So yeah. Granted, yes. Is there a chance that I miss out of the Tour Championship by a point or by 5 points and everyone's going to be like, oh, you should have gone to Pittsburgh, man. That was stupid of you. Sure. But me, literally, I was just on the road for 4 weeks.
Yeah.
I'm about to be on the road again if everything goes well for like another 4 weeks, basically with MVP, GMC, MVP, Tour Championship, USDGC, Battle for Bedford.
Maybe
like
5 weeks.
Yeah. Might be 5 weeks. And then don't forget the Halloween Classics right after. So It's yeah, so it's gonna be a busy end of the season. So this is really the only tournament out of all those that I like was even close to like dropping. So I think if you're in the points mode like me, it makes sense to drop this tournament. If you're in the money mode or like
USDGC spots is big at this tournament.
Oh, there's USDGC spots at this tournament?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, so that's another
and
huge one.
Like no field there.
That's huge. So you're going to get people to show up for that. But then I think also, what else are they going to do, right? There's a lot of people. Yeah. Like I knew leaving, I knew this was my plan all along of where essentially as long as I played okay at some of these tournaments, I knew I was going to be in the mix for points, that it wasn't super drastic that I need to go there. So my plan all along was driving from Texas to all these events and then driving back home. Because it's only like it was only a 6.5 hour drive from Emporia back to Dallas. But if you are, you know, if you don't have a home and you're living out of your van, what else are you going to do, right?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, so there's those people as well that maybe there's an A tier tournament that they love that they might play and yada yada. But for the most part, you're going to see people at this tournament that, like you said, haven't qualified USDGC. Need the tour points to try to get in the tour championship or need the money / what else are they going to do?
Yeah. Now, when do you head to GMC?
I'll probably go up on Monday.
Okay, so next week when we film the show, you should be up there, and that'll be your first time seeing those courses, correct?
Yeah, I've just watched the coverage. Brewster, Brewster seems like your typical, like, just short wooded course. I'm sure you've watched coverage, so you kind of have an idea of what the course looks like.
Yeah.
It's not like Champions Cup, New London, Northwoods. No. It's not like that of where you're like throwing your, you know, some of these holes you're having to throw multiple big shots. Like, it's very placement oriented woods disc golf. So I look forward to that. That's fun. We haven't really played a tournament like that in a while. Idlewild kind of for some of the holes, but also Idlewild has a lot of open holes too. So that'll be nice. And then Fox Run just looks like a really cool mixture of holes with OB and that. So I think this tournament's going to be, we'll see how it plays out, but I think it's going to be one of my favorite, at least to compete in, because it's going to be such a big difference between the two.
It's always been on my bucket list. I've never made it out there to just go to those courses. I think we want to maybe next year try to do a bogey bro battle up there, because it also is like on a resort, I believe, to where it was an easy sell. I actually, at one point, I think when Worlds was there, 2018, I was planning on, I'd already sold Liz on going out there, renting a room, being like, yeah, it's a nice resort. We'll be in Vermont. You know, it's going to be great. Watch Worlds, all of this. And I forget why we ended up not going. But
we should plan on going. It's going to be Worlds next year, I think. So.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Worlds going back there next year.
Yeah, so we should plan on having Foundation all up there for Worlds.
A Foundation Worlds trip to Vermont. Sounds easy to me.
Yeah.
That's an easy sell.
It's not that far away.
That's a little far, but not. It's probably like 12 or 13 hours. We drove to St. Louis.
That's kind of far. Distance. That's kind of far.
It might actually be more than that. I don't know. But we'll fly there. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
We also, next year, want to go hit Maple Hill as well, which I know you haven't played Maple Hill either.
No.
So you're hitting both of these tournaments first time. Both, I think, very
exciting. Haven't played Hornets Nest either, or wherever they're going to have.
It's not Hornets Nest. We know that, but that's all we know.
Wherever they're going to have.
The Tour Championship.
Yeah.
From what I understand, it's in Charlotte, not at Hornets Nest. So, be interesting, but. All right, I think that about wraps the show up, unless you have something we didn't touch on you wanted to go over.
I guess just a quick breakdown of like how my Worlds went real fast for those that.
I guess we didn't do that.
Yeah, I didn't really.
Storylines.
Yeah, that's. I did mention that I was going to talk a little bit about that on debate night. So for those that actually are interested, stick around. If you're not, peace. See you next time. It was definitely a frustrating week for me. I thought these courses suited my game really well, and I was very, very excited to get the chance at trying to put together a good tournament. Round one, I actually didn't even play that well, but still managed to shoot 7 under, which didn't take me completely out of the tournament, kept me in the mix. Unfortunately, if you would have told me after round one, like, that was going to be your best round of the tournament, I would have bet a lot of money against that. But it ended up being the best round of the tournament, unfortunately. There was really some good spots and highlights. You know, I shot 7 under on the back nine at Country Club, which I think was, it might have been the best. I'm trying to think. Ezra had a hole in one.
Yeah. And 12, that was thrilling.
And I think someone else eagled 14, so they might have shot 8. I don't know. Maybe not. 8's a lot. No, Gavin Rathbun might have shot 8 because he aced 16. So he might have shot 8. But I think 7 was pretty much like top tier as far as back nines go. The back nine is obviously a lot harder at Country Club than the front. But I shot +2 on the front, so that kind of negated what I did on the back. And that it was just a very frustrating – it was so hard, like – this was one of those tournaments that it would have been really, really easy for me to just to shut down and like kind of pack it in, miss the cut and say deuces and join you guys for the live stream just because of how bad my game was. But I just grinded as hard as I could to stay in the mix a little bit for the cut. But it was hard. Like, those weeks are the hardest, is when it just putting feels hard. Upshots feel hard. You don't know where discs are going. Clicking. Yeah, and just trying to somehow manage a score is very, very difficult. The only positive I have leaving, and I texted this to you guys too, is like my power forehand now has been tournament tested and feels great. And I tweaked a couple things. I've been tweaking it like the last couple months to try to get to this point. And hopefully it's there. The practice rounds I've been playing the last couple days, I just did field work yesterday. It still feels good. It's now just trying to work on a couple different release angles. But, you know, the easiest, like hole 3, for example, at Country Club, if you remember, or sorry, not hole 3, hole 4, the new one. So hole 1's the par 5, hole 2's the par 4. Down, with OB down the left. Hole 3 is a really long downhill par 3. And then hole 4 is like that left to right where like I think the famous shot there was Paul's skipped off the green.
Skipping, yeah.
And then bounced over the wall. So I was throwing like a Spike Heiser forehand on that hole.
Oh,
and
nice. Wow.
And it's 385 uphill. And a lot of people were taking like, were either going up the middle or doing kind of like that low skip off the green. Yeah. And I was essentially just throwing kind of like a Spike Heiser stall shot. And ended up almost going OB long on one of them. So that felt really good that the forehand was kind of, hole 9's another good example, like the one that's out of the woods, like the L shape hole.
Yeah.
One of the days I was looking right at the basket. So like I got past the whole L shape and almost was OB long. So as far as that goes, I don't know how much use that will be at GMC. It doesn't look like that many of the wooded holes require big forehands. And Fox Run, from the coverage wise, it didn't really look like a lot of people were throwing forehands. But I know going forward, that is a weapon to have that you can bust out and, you know, I don't know if anyone's mentioned this, but like, I think Eagle would have been in the mix to win if he could have thrown a forehand.
Someone asked that. A big thing with Eagle was obviously the hole, which I don't know how much truly affected him, where he like,
oh no, it affected him. It affected him.
It seemed like it did.
No, Ezra was playing with him and like,
oh, when that happened?
Yeah, he was playing with him when it happened, and he literally said there was a noticeable difference between his putting before and after. And like, he would just like look at his hand and his hand would just be covered in blood. So it was, there are times where you hear people say stuff and you're like, you take it at face value. You're like, yeah, sure. And you're like, that probably didn't really have an impact.
Yeah.
I think the glass in his hand actually had a huge impact, but regardless of that, I don't know if he still would have been able to compete if he didn't have that.
It asked for a lot of forehands.
The forehand at Country Club, obviously, you watch Gossage, Tristan Tanner just shred that course. It would have been really interesting to see what he could have done with his forehand at that course. Because yeah. it takes OB out of so many holes of where you're having to throw those like tricky like turnover shots with the backhand. And if you don't get the angle just right, it's going to fade out early and go OB. Like just being able to throw an overstable spike hyzer forehand just takes out so much of that trouble. So that'll be an unfortunate one. It would have been really fun to see him compete too at that one. Cause I think that those courses, obviously with his length, you look at the leaderboard after the first couple rounds, right? And it's like, what? All big throwers. Mm-hmm. Garrett Gerthy was up there. Anthony Barella was up there. You know, the big dogs, Drew Gibson, I think was up there too. So it's, obviously it was a course that if you could throw far, you definitely had some advantage, but I think that went down at ECC distance was not nearly as advantageous as Jones. The distance actually helped you a lot. ECC being able to throw far didn't really have that much of an advantage.
Interesting. Yeah. You would have thought it was the opposite, but that makes a lot of sense. Just because one's a golf course, but the way it played. Yeah. That's definitely right. So,
yeah, you're never Jones. There was multiple holes where you know, I'm trying to throw 500 plus feet. Hole one, I'm not even trying to throw 500 plus feet at Country Club.
No,
there's no reason. Yeah. I just throw a 450 foot spike hyzer, 450 foot spike hyzer, and then I have a 300 foot upshot.
Yeah.
So
that definitely makes no sense.
But yeah, we'll see. We'll see how the end of the year plays out. You know, like you said, like Pittsburgh, it'll be interesting to see. Do you got that list updated of notable names that haven't qualified? Because I know like a bunch just qualified.
There's not many left. I don't know if there's any left actually notable names wise.
Really? They all qualified at Worlds? I think there was still a handful.
Who was left at Worlds?
There was so Tristan Tanner got one. Ben Callaway, who got ninth, got one. And Eric Oakley got it at Worlds.
I was thinking like mid-season there was like Mason Ford was on the list, Adam Hamm was on the list.
Jake Mon, he got it.
He was the one, he was from the B pool. He was the one that popped up into 20th from the B pool.
Okay, these are people, and Grant, you can tell me whether or not these names are notable or not. These are people that haven't qualified yet. Austin Turner, Jake Heibenheimer, Silas Schultz, Colton Montgomery.
Colton's pretty significant.
Connor O'Reilly won a national tour event.
Won an NT a little bit ago, yeah.
Kale LaVisca.
That's a big one.
Logan Harpool. Linus Carlson.
Yeah, that's tough because I'm sure there's some Europeans.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's some other Europeans that just don't have the chances.
Johnny McRae, Matt Bell, James Proctor.
There's some big names. Seppo's not going to be able to, I don't think.
Those are all the people. Well, I guess I can't see. I would have to go to this to see the rest of the leaderboard. All right, what do you think? We'll end it on this. Is Trevor in there?
No.
Is it just you?
It's just me right now, yep.
All right, fair enough. All right, what is your guess? I won't say the name because that's kind of mean, but what is your guess at the highest finish at Worlds? How much over par?
Oh, like the worst. Dead last place?
Dead last. How much over par was dead last?
68 over.
94.
Gosh darn it.
350.
Was it the 913 rated player at least?
I have no idea. 356 shots in four rounds. Paul, 282 in five.
Because the extra round.
100
That's
shots.
Only across four rounds.
100 shots. Jeez. Less throws in four rounds.
With
an extra round. Gives you a little perspective.
Brutal.
But there you have it. We haven't done this in a while, so if you haven't yet and you're looking for a place to shop for discs, go to foundationdisc.com. It's the best place to get discs.
Yeah, we actually have a pretty big Discraft restock going up the rest of this week. I think hopefully it'll all be up by the end of this week. So if you're looking for some discs you haven't seen in a while from Discraft, we're actually going to be hitting the site here pretty soon. We got a lot of different molds in. So
also, we have some exciting new Dark Horse stuff that will be available from Discraft for retailers.
Oh, fascinating.
Because like right now it's just the Brody Swirl Roaches, which I think we're almost sold out of those on site, right? There's only 10.
Yeah, so they're getting low.
And then Get Freaky, we never can keep those in store.
Yeah, I don't think we currently have any.
So there's a I know at least there's one item and maybe two items. So keep a lookout at that.
All right.
I don't know if that was a good teaser or not, but that's
a great teaser. I'm interested.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you have it. Well, that's going to be debate night. We'll talk to you again next Tuesday, same time, same place, and we'll get Brody's, hopefully his recap of his first practice round out at GMC. But if not, we'll at least get the preview of what's about to go down. So we'll talk to you next week.